I've got one piece of evidence for that, that in Chicago there wasn't a single hotel built or new office building, large office building hotel built until the 1950s. I'm wondering if you have supporting data or other things that
The fact that there wasn't a hotel built for more than 5 years after the war in Chicago gives you some idea about the lasting impact on our real standard of living. The issue of did the World War II get us out of the Great Depression was really settled, I think, by Robert Higgs, in an article in the Journal of Economic History back in 1992, and he actually opens the article with a quote from Ludwig von Mises. And basically what Higgs showed was that the level of consumption by Americans during World War II was actually a little bit lower than the level of consumption during the Great Depression, so that Americans, in their ability to consume, were actually worse off during the Great Depression. And so he argues that World War II did not get us out of the Great Depression, and that it was the ending of the war that actually got us out of a 15-year depression.
Can you get me a copy of that article?
I sure can. And I actually was very interested in that subject for a number of years. And I actually did some sophisticated econometrics on the stock market during that period. And what I found out, and this is the only known case that I know of, is that on the day that Roosevelt's death was reported, the stock market actually started a rebound that hadn't experienced for over 15 years, really. And it's so you could think of Roosevelt's death as getting us out of the Great Depression, not what he did in terms of policies. Yes.
How would you respond to the claim that the world economy helped us get the internet and atomic energy and things like that? People claim that good things come out of war economy.
Well, there are a few things that that do come out of these massive government programs. In terms of beating the Russians to the moon, we didn't get much out of that at all. But we did get Tang, supplement, vitamin C supplement. But there are a few things that relate it. Now, atomic energy, of course, would have been developed anyways. It's really an alternative fuel. It doesn't have any. It has very limited superior uses, where existing fuel could be used in a better way. But also, you have the simple fact that the government is using massive amounts of resources in these projects. So you have to think in terms of what was the alternative use of all those resources. Sure, you might generate a few seeds of technology or innovation, but the overall impact is very, very limited, I would say.
Yeah, what is seen and not seen, right?
Yes. I'm finishing up my initial commitment as an officer, a junior officer now. Well, actually, with this war, they put a stop loss in place to keep people from getting out. Hopefully that lifts in the next couple months if I can. But a couple things they do, just to give you an idea of the mentality of the senior leadership and the typical junior officer in the military today, to his question, they're constantly spreading propaganda that these sorts of projects are what really is the backbone of the American economy. One general came by to talk to us about retention issues and said that the American military deserves the credit for the great economy of the past 5 years because we've kept the world, kept them in line. They also use it's just the mentality that these people are too stupid to invest their stuff in technology that would work unless we did it for them. Mm-hmm. And they really buy that, so they really are socialists. They may pass themselves off as cultural conservatives, but they're socialists in their thinking. They're bureaucrats. But the effect morally, because you're talking about the moral effect, especially on younger people, is the thing that's detrimental these people talk about bringing out courage or that sort of thing. Certainly, difficult trying situations bring out the courage in individual people. There's also tend to be the individual people that will stand up for something when everyone else is going along the party line. And that is exactly what they kill from the very beginning. They talk about excellence, but from the very beginning, like for instance at the Air Force Academy, they kill any sense of individual responsibility.
That's right, because you have to be...
They kill it outright and say, if you, whatever happens, if your so-and-so messes up, then it's on your head. But the thing that they inject that makes it even worse is that people tend to stop their moral reasoning at the level that they can justify, that they find a level of moral justification for their lives, and then anything beyond that, they can live however they want. And what the military does, especially among younger people, is it says, what you're doing is you're serving your country and you're being selfless, and therefore you're a good person no matter what else you do with yourself and your time. And it really promotes a hedonistic, nihilistic perspective towards other things. Yet they still retain the pride that tells them that they're self-righteous in their actions.
Well, it's, everybody's got to have a party line in that. Or, you know, there's a good deal of, for lack of a better term, brainwashing to get a unit to serve under such difficult circumstances. It's not surprising that all armies have done that, you know, except for mercenary armies, all the way back in time.
And democracy makes it worse because it gives you this abstraction that you're supposedly supporting. You're not, you know, taking an oath to Hitler, you're taking an oath to this document as a way of life.
One of the things I was thinking of was sort of connecting the earlier point and what Gene was talking about in terms of mathematics was the recent movie, The Beautiful Mind, that came out that where you have all these mathematicians and these modelers and decipherers and stuff, the greatest minds in American society, and what's the whole show about is bringing these the most capable minds in society and putting them into these military spy-type think tanks. And, of course, what was actually going on, even though, what's his name?
Nash
was given the most prestigious position in one of these institutes, he gets there and is bored to tears. Basically doesn't have anything to do. He and his staff of leading mathematicians are not really doing very much. Of course, ultimately, a few of them did make, you know, deciphering codes and that sort of thing, very successful. But, you know, in total, you have a massive mental capital investment on the part of the military, taking that out of the private sector and bringing it into the public sector and seeing very little productivity come about as a result.
Jim, I've got a question to you about the financial models we have. And it's quite interesting. But I found it a bit puzzling, like, if you guys have to adjust each time there's some particular change, why do you have those models at all? I mean, what's the point? I mean, if things are following a particular trend line, then you don't need any models. I mean, like in the bull market, I remember there was a lady who used to do extremely well and asked her, what's the principle? She was listening to the barking of the dog. If the dog would bark twice, she would buy. If it barked only once, she would sell. She was doing extremely well. Yeah? The trend is upwards. It doesn't matter what you do. You're just doing well, right? And so, I mean, so if you have a model, all of a sudden, your things are changing, and you're sort of gauging this, and you change the model, stop the model. Why to have it? Why bother? I mean, it's just cutting yourself.
What I'd say is that The model can, you have to develop a model robust enough to withstand minor changes in interpretation in the market. When I say they stop it and change it, you know, often in a day, the model may run all day trading the deal for all the traders and never be stopped. Working on this, I had said that, you know, the model can, you have to change the model when you get a major change in reinterpretation. I stopped and thought, well, what's major? Well, major is what? How much margin does your model give you? You know, these people are looking for 3 cents a share, and, you know, it's only an interpretation that's going to throw things off by more than that, makes them stop the model. What they get out of it is, and they're not looking at a trend, you know, doing Apple and I and Sun are gone, but you know, they're not picking market direction or anything. They're just looking for stocks coming out of a set parameter. There's a whole bunch of things they feed into it. You know, the details of the model are very proprietary, but what they get to do is they can let the computer trade all day, most days for them. And as I said, you know, they've done this for years and churned out this 3 cents a share for a number of years doing it.
They
keep developing it. They keep developing it. But what they're not doing, no trader is sitting there going, now I think I buy Sun. Now I think I sell Apple. It's only when it looks to the trader, and that's why I say it's not an elimination of entrepreneurial judgment. When it looks to the trader as though the model, something is not fitting with it, they stop it, think about it, perhaps input new parameters. They keep evolving it when they find, they keep analyzing the P&L over all the mergers they're doing and keep evolving it.
But yes. It sounds to me, from especially your explanation about mergers, that a lot of people do that on a fundamental basis without using the computer. They're looking for a bigger chunk. You're using a computer to try to get those little chunks.
Yeah, without the computerization, the tiny increments we're looking to pick up would be, we couldn't do it so fast and so frequently during the day. We couldn't keep picking up those 3 cents all day long.
It sounds like it's very different from what long-term capital management did, where they seem to be aspiring to sort of find the model that would explain the whole world and sort of make money forever. Wasn't that your sense of the culture of that place?
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with them, but yeah, and I think they got unhedged too. I think they wound up seriously unhedged. One thing we try to do is always be market neutral. You know, the Enron 102,000 shares was, purely a computer bug. We are never net long or net short. We're always looking to buy and sell at the same time.
But long-term capital at the beginning was just like this firm. They were just carving the difference between a cash security and a future security in the bond market. Bond market arbitrage. It's very, very similar, just looking for tiny incremental change and doing it on a leverage basis.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that happened was they kept getting capital and they didn't have enough of that to invest in. So they started going out into riskier and riskier things. These people keep returning capital to the partners, because they only want the amount of capital that they see they can do this arbitrage with.
Are there results audited by anybody?
Can
we get a copy, maybe?
It's a private firm.
Well, that's the advantage of being a private firm. They can say anything to you they want.
Well, but they have to give me my return on the capital. Yeah. Now, it could be that they're giving me that and they didn't really make it. They just like me. But I don't.
People in this kind of work say all kinds of things all day long.
Yeah. Sure, but as I said, the cash is there at the end of the year.
At the end of the day, it's just like a guy who developed a way to beat the roulette table by a penny at a time. That's not the investment process. There's nothing entrepreneurial about it.
Yes.
This question is for you, Mark. Apart from all the bad things that you said that happened during war, what do you think about this theory about blowbacks or unintended consequences?
Well, war certainly has a lot of unintended consequences. It results in new entangling alliances. It results, of course, even for the victor in a war, that you're going to be long-term involved in the affairs of other countries, that sort of thing. I'm not sure exactly what the area of unintended consequences you're referring to, because there's so many domestic, economic, personal liberties. The list is really endless. Is there a specific area that you were thinking about?
Well, there was one mention, I think that came by someone from the CIA, and saying like the things that are happening. I mean, this person in particular mentions that when there was the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, that the new power that came was actually even worse than overthrowing this regime.
And the same thing could be said about Afghanistan itself, where you had a fairly neutral regime replaced by the Russians, and then we're in there covertly supporting the Mujahideen and the groups like Bin Laden's people were part of, it does seem to always get worse over time when you start involving yourself covertly in these regimes. A lot of that stuff has come home to roost, and it just seems to get worse. The Iran case has certainly has been that way for quite a long time, and of course Afghanistan is really a very unfortunate circumstance. Short-term gain for a very long-term loss.
Is it true that big financial institutions throughout history have provoked two different groups to cause a war so they can finance it and make money? Is that the deal?
Well, big financial firms are definitely involved in here. As a matter of fact, I think I forgot to put the fourth economy up there, which is the devil economy, and the financing and the big banks, that sort of thing were in that component of the economy. The devils, the group of devils, they're the ones that do benefit from the war. Of course, you're making munitions, you have to finance the war, you have to finance the debt, and all of that is a big money-making process. And so in every war in the United States and most other places, the Revolutionary War, Spanish-American War, certainly the Civil War on the northern side, World War I and II, they all resulted in big gains for the people who were helping the government finance the war itself. And so to the extent that they're in there provoking the war, I'm not really familiar with a lot of that, but they certainly end up benefiting from it as a result. Question over here?
Yeah, Gene, I found the Mises quote really fascinating about entrepreneurial profit. Is he basically saying that the entrepreneurial profit, whether it be to entrepreneurs or investors, goes to the contrarian?
Well, if everyone already knows that the changed circumstances are going to increase the demand for wheat. The demand for wheat will, the price for wheat will already be at the final level that reflects that change. So he's in several places in Human Action, he says it's people who first understand, the people who earliest understand what the impact of some change will be, correctly understand it, will be the ones who get entrepreneurial profits.
Is there also maybe a lesson here for the Austrian economics movement that if all the mainstream economists basically agree with us, that we ought to just sort of keep a low profile? And if they're all saying the same thing and they totally disagree with us, should we be shouting from the rooftops?
Well, bring in market thinking to intellectual truth is, it doesn't map one to one. I think you try to say the truth, whatever you think it is. There's been some back and forth in the journals on, has Austrian economics passed the market test, or has it failed the market test? That's a misapplication, to me. You can't bring market thinking into this search for intellectual truth. The A squared plus B squared equals C squared, even if most investors don't think so, right?
I'm just wondering whether you're a pacifist or whether what wars in American history do you think could have been avoided, if any?
What wars could have been avoided?
Well, recently, yeah. I mean, I'm just saying
you know, of course, at the Civil War, if both sides decided not to do it, it wouldn't happen. But that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, you know, we could have decided at the end of World War I or so. I'm just wondering if you're not making that kind of argument, are you?
No, I haven't. I would say our involvement in well, I'm not sure where to start. In modern times, you go backward or start back and go forward. The Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War I and II, Korea, Vietnam, the current crisis. The Civil War is a tough one.
You're saying these other wars we should have not entered?
Yes, I would say that they could have been avoided, yes.
Could have been avoided is different than saying we should not have entered it.
That's right, but he asked.
How could you avoid
World War II? No, I
said, how could you avoid it?
How could you avoid World War II?
Stay out of World War I.
Not getting into World War I.
Yeah, stay out of World War I. That's a good start.
No, but it's a hindsight kind of your history, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, just a few minor things. You know, if somebody had done something right before Pearl Harbor, we could have avoided that.
My point, Marco, what you said is that, you know, I understand that the United States foreign policy has oftentimes been aggressive and arrogant, having people stationed in 140 countries around the world. I view that a little bit excessive. But on the other hand, once someone attacks you at your home base, and once you realize someone who attacks you is an irrational human being, how are you going to get, you have to do something.
That's right.
Now, you're telling me what we're doing wrong, but you're not saying what we should have done instead. Having a national homeland security, expanding the government, perhaps it's a little bit difficult, but what else could you have done under the same circumstances? That's my point. I mean, Dr. Hoppe says maybe we can get AIG and Prudential to send out mercenaries, but that's totally unrealistic and fairly idiotic, really.
Well, I think that the issues like Pearl Harbor and the trade towers, when I say they could have been avoided, what I'm thinking of most directly is the fact that in both cases, if one person or one federal agency or branch of the military out of a couple of dozen in both cases had done a decent job, those things could have been avoided. And so they could have been avoided in that sense. I mean, in both cases, there's a sort of...
But when something happens, what do you do?
Well, I'm not much on in terms of...
How do you provide security for so many airports and so many places when you're dealing with an enemy you can't even pinpoint?
Joe is...
When anything happens, like the World Trade Tower attack, I mean, that was a criminal action. You allow the criminal justice to take care of it, and then you permit private property owners, the owner, you know, to privatize the airport, but allow the airline, which is already private, to take steps to protect their passengers. Okay? If they don't do that, then they're going to lose money and go out of business. Or if they do too much of it and become too vexatious, and they take their shoes off and steal your screwdriver to your eyeglass, which they did to me, then you don't go to that one either. You have competition. You allow the private property owners who are threatened to respond. And then you're protecting the borders of the whole land.
And number one, the airports are not private property.
Yeah, they should.
And they should.
Well, there's what I was responding to in the question was that if we had a lot of those things, as well as just any sort of compliance with what these people were supposed to be doing at the time, and it's only in hindsight that we go back and look at this sort of systemic incompetence, but those things could have very easily been avoided entirely. Not to say that that would have solved the problem, but there are, as Joe suggested, other ways of addressing those issues.
Well, the big question is, why do they want to do it to us? That's because we're meddling. They're taking out their revenge on us because they feel like we're meddling in their affairs. And if they feel completely justified in what they're doing, now we don't feel justified, but most people don't in this country don't understand how much the United States is meddling in everybody's affairs. Mm-hmm. We got our nose in, like the gentleman said, 140, 150 different countries. And as soon as you put troops in there, one group's going to love you, And the other group ain't going to like it. And they're going to have people get hurt, they're going to get killed, and they're going to have revenge on their mind.
Yeah, it's important, you know, and economics is always talking about rationality and, you know, and Americans looking at these other groups who may be attacking us or doing strange things in their own country. We don't see them as being rational from our perspective. You have to look at it from, you have to look at issues and events from the people you're actually judging.
It's not, they're not irrational human beings, as the gentleman said. It's not, that's not the issue. And with Saudi, you know, if the U.S. government, you can't use something that has happened. He said that we're looking at history with hindsight. Joseph, history is hindsight. Hindsight all the way back. And you have to look before and ask what caused it. Plus, a single event cannot be used as a trump card for to justify anyone's program. What happened with the trade tower cannot be used to justify the entire neocon program, which includes, if they were serious, they'd pull out of Saudi Arabia for two huge reasons. A, the oil interests, or the two huge reasons they don't, the oil interests that are involved, where the Rockefeller, I mean, Rothbard documented this in his essays for the Rothbard report. And the second thing that the Saudi Arabian government does, plays a hypocritical role besides having us protect our own, is they promote the very brand of Islamic fundamentalism that doesn't. And, but no one has ever even mentioned within the circles that possibility. So the motive of the people in power who we are implicitly giving, you know, many people are implicitly giving their assent to, is entirely different than actually protecting the life and property of the United States, people in the United States. That's not their motive. Mm-hmm. So you can't assign them that motive after the fact. So if we get something bad out, they still must be called to the carpet.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah. Maybe this question is too big. You know, it seems like the pages are filled with every day with another con job being exposed, like, you know, the Enron situation, Argentina, and these are always sort of a big shock to people, you know, after the fact. In the case of Argentina, I think it's listed, you know, very high in the index of economic freedom, and, you know, you remember this? And Forbes magazine had article after article about the glorious currency system. And I guess Enron got very good press. What are the things that you look for to sort of spot the frauds that are out there? How do you sort of anticipate these things? What are the telltale signs?
The most telltale sign is it's too good to be true. And if you lived in Houston and you knew people who worked for Enron, and you were actually looking at the company, one of the things, the company was suppressing any bad news and promoting all of the good news. So it really did appear to everyone that that things were too good to be true if you really looked at it. You know, the CEO had a beach home in Galveston, and liked it so much he built two more on either side. And even though he only goes down there a few weekends out of the year, he has a butler there who's making $140,000 a year. I mean, you see things like that and you think,
but I don't think watch out. I don't think it's the only thing. To answer your question, I think if you look at a company's financial statements, to the extent that there's some opaqueness in there, or well, there more questions than answers, it's time to close it up and pick up another one.
So I think an interesting question is where you can't look, which is oftentimes you can't look to Wall Street research, which doesn't often expose a lot of this.
Yeah, by the economy, the business class or whatever.
Because there's a real moral hazard there.
That's
they're
right.
They're not incentivized to expose these frauds right now.
The Cisco fraud, for example, or what may come in the future as a J.P. Morgan Chase thing, you don't know.
No one's
expecting it, but
yeah.
It will
come. Well, when you see somebody put their name on a new stadium, that's all you need.
To come back to Tony's earlier point, you know, one thing is the trading inside this company is all completely open. It's up on the internet inside the company as it happens, and it's all computer generated. And so it's not a possibility that someone is, you know, hand finagling these things. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't suggest that.
Yeah.
But also we have like 60% on partners' capital can be nothing because you can borrow so much money now.
Oh, they're very leveraged. They're very leveraged, absolutely.
$100 of the capital, you can do
Yeah, 85.
I don't think that's the investment process. I think the investment process requires just a big nose, some common sense, and ability to read transcripts.
Yeah, well, there's different kinds of ways to make money in the market. If your puzzle is what economic role they're playing, they're finding mispricings. You know, are you familiar with...
The book in Las Vegas was developed a system at the roulette table, obviously then has some economic role as well. I don't see a distinction between the two.
Well, you're familiar with reversals and conversions in the option market?
Sure.
Yeah. They find them all the time. And when you find a reversal and conversion, you have two securities that are not priced correctly. And they're able to discover them all day long and just pick up money. But the activity that they do corrects the mispricing because they're buying the underpriced security and selling the overpriced one. So the market would not stay roughly rational unless someone was busy looking for the mispricings and correcting them.
Gene, how did when the government forced the exchange to go from fractions to pennies, how did that have any effect on your business?
Pricing became somewhat more tighter margins. That may also have something to do with the drop in return last year. Yeah, definitely. There was some programs, in fact, we abandoned due to that.
Gene, what's the possibility that this will be declared unfair? There seems to be some pretty good profits in it, and this is exactly the kind of thing the government would like to call unfair or something like that, and put an end to it.
Geez, I haven't heard about anything developing in that way, and they don't seek any publicity. They're private. They just mind their business and churn out. You know, the profit margins sound fantastic, but as Tony points out, they're trading on a good bit of margin, and a lot of it is the fact that they've been at it for years. They're good at it. A lot of it is really their wages, because they know what they're doing so well. You know, a lot of what looks like return on capital is really wages on their labor. So I don't see anything on the horizon.